fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A wonderful Wednesday to you. Man, what a show we've got for you. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. Once again, toll free. The call's on me. 1-888-914-9149. You can email the program, K-L-C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. It's a great place to send your questions, possible show topics. Want to hear from you. Kale at relevantradio.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Kale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Kale Clark Show. We also have one for the Faith Explained show, too, at Faith Explained. So check that one out while you're there. Well, I want to talk to you about what Pope Benedict said about overcoming your fear. And, you know, fear is something that we always have to deal with. There's a lot going on in the world, and it can really make us afraid. And he said this almost 20 years ago, 19 years ago, on this day, October the 6th, 2002. Now, this is before he was Pope. He was then Cardinal Ratzinger. And this was a great, great speech that he gave. And it was on the occasion of the canonization of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, who was the founder of Opus Dei. And he was canonized as a saint on this day, October the 6th, 2002. And Pope Benedict gave a great little talk about this. And here's what he said. He said, "A man open to the presence of God discovers that God is always working and still works today. We should then let him enter and let him work." He said, "I have always been struck by the interpretation which Jose Maria Escrivá gave the name Opus Dei, an interpretation which we could call biographical and which allows us to understand the founder in his spiritual dimension. Escrivá knew that he should found something, but he was always aware that whatever it was not his work, that he had not invented anything, that the Lord had simply made use of him. Thus, it was not his work, but Opus Dei, which is Latin for work of God. He was only an instrument with which God had acted." And it's true, for many years before St. Jose Maria began Opus Dei, which really God began it through him, and he always saw himself just as an instrument. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he knew that for many, many years, God wanted him to do something, ever since he was a young man, and he just couldn't figure it out. He just said, "Lord, let me see." That was his prayer, and he prayed that for years. "Lord, let me see. Lady, let it be." You know, it's like the Beatles, "Let it be, let it be." And so he asked Mama Mary to pray for him as well. And eventually he got the answer many, many years later. But along the way, he thought, you know, he actually wanted to be an architect, but he thought, "I have a funny feeling God's going to ask me to do something. And just in case, I will sort of let myself sort of be available to his service. I'll become a priest. Maybe that's the best way to do this." And after he became a priest, he got the call on October the 2nd, 1928. That's when God revealed to him or showed him Opus Dei. And he really never really talked too much about that. It was a real supernatural experience. And there's a movie that came out a few years ago called There Be Dragons. I don't know if you've seen it. It's kind of a cool movie. And it's really about the time that Opus Dei got started in Spain in the 1920s, late 1920s, early 1930s. And the Spanish Civil War was kind of the backdrop of that. This is a very bloody conflict. Most people don't know anything about the Spanish Civil War, but Catholics were being murdered in the streets, priests and nuns. It was just an absolute bloodbath, and the church was right in the middle of it. And so it was a pretty dangerous time for Catholics in Spain, including St. Jose Maria and the early members of Opus Dei. So it's kind of like an adventure movie in a certain sense. But in that movie, St. Jose Maria is played by Charlie Cox, the actor who also played Daredevil in the Daredevil series on Netflix. I love comic book stuff. So I thought, hey, I can't get away from it. Whenever I see Daredevil, I'm like, hey, it's St. Jose Maria in a costume. But it was the same actor, Charlie Cox. And the way they kind of did it in the movie when God revealed to him Opus Dei was kind of interesting. He kind of has this vision, and he looks sort of, he's in this building, and he kind of looks through the floor, and he sees all these people looking back up at him, and they're firemen, policemen, doctors, teachers, whatever, construction workers, any kind of occupation you can imagine. And in the midst of them, there is Jesus working in the carpentry shop. And so this whole idea that our work is in many ways an arena for our sanctification and ordinary life as well. And because Opus Dei was really, it's about finding God in everyday life, and that's something that any Christian, any person can really find some value in that message, since it's so much about finding God in the ordinary. And so St. Jose Maria always used to say, if you don't find God in the ordinary things of every day, you're not going to find him at all. So yes, we want to sometimes, you know, hear the voice from heaven and see the supernatural, whatever, but we need to learn how to find him in the everyday experiences of life, because that's where he's waiting for us. And so he didn't talk too much in real life about that vision. At least I'm not aware of anything. And I think I'm just kind of assuming, I'm reading something into this, but I have a funny feeling that he didn't talk too much about the supernatural experience that he had on October the 2nd, 1928, because he didn't want to draw attention away from the fact that it really is about finding God in the ordinary. And that was a special, special supernatural experience. So after he had this experience, his confessor, the priest that he was going to for confession and some spiritual direction, happened to be a Jesuit priest. And he was the guy who actually coined that term, Opus Dei, because Father Jose Maria would go and talk to this guy, go to confession, and the priest would ask him, oh, by the way, how's that work of God going? How's that work of God going? And he didn't really know what to call it, and Jose Maria didn't have a name for it. He said, that's actually a pretty good line. I like that. Work of God, Opus Dei in Latin. Maybe that's what I'll call it. That's what God wants. So that's where that kind of came from. And tragically, that same priest who heard his confessions, was his director, coined the name. Later on, he became a great enemy of, and St. Jose Maria would always say, I don't have any enemies. I only have benefactors, you know, and people have, even my enemies, you know, do me good. They draw me back to prayer. They, you know, give me a chance to forgive. And this guy, unfortunately, turned on Jose Maria, turned on Opus Dei, and he thought of it as being something really bad. And actually, a lot of the Jesuits, unfortunately, in Spain at that time, late 1920s, early 1930s, they really had a major, major suspicion about St. Jose Maria, about Opus Dei. And a lot of the stuff that you hear about Opus Dei to this day, it actually comes from these guys. A lot of the stuff that was in the Da Vinci Code, all the kind of wild, crazy rumors, a lot of it was really started by these Spanish Jesuits in the 1930s. Why? Because they were ticked off that, number one, at a human level, a lot of guys who were thinking about becoming Jesuits, when they met St. Jose Maria and they found out, oh, I can become a saint as an engineer. Like, I mean, I don't have to leave my studies and do something else. I don't have to go to a seminary. I mean, if God calls me to do that, great. But, or I could be in business. I could be in medicine. No matter what my profession is, I can be a canonizable saint. Cool. That's really interesting to me. So a lot of guys that maybe were thinking about becoming Jesuits, they were losing a lot of these vocations, and people were becoming interested in Opus Dei. And they didn't like that. So they started this kind of campaign where they would go to these guys' parents and say, this guy's a heretic, Jose Maria, don't let your kids near this guy. And he really suffered a lot. He really did. But he never had any animosity towards them. And in fact, he called them God's platinum scalpel that God used to, you know, shape him and mold him, as painful as it was, some of these persecutions. But really, people did think that St. Jose Maria was a heretic, that he was a false teacher. This idea that anybody can become a saint? Come on, that holiness is for nuns, for priests, for religious, for monks. It's not for lay people. Lay people are simply supposed to pay, pray, and obey. You maybe heard that line. That's a really bad saying that a lot of very clerical people used to say. Not everybody. But there was this kind of mentality in the church at that time that you really had to be a cleric, you had to be a priest or a bishop or a member of a religious order to become a saint. And most people who were canonized were priests and religious, let's face it. John Paul II changed that a lot during his pontificate, canonized so many lay people, again, because he wanted to say that holiness is something that's attainable, that all of us should become, not just can become, but we should become saints by virtue of our baptism. That's our call, to become saints and help other people to become saints. Holiness and apostolate, that's what it's all about. And so he really admired St. Jose Maria a lot, Pope John Paul II, and he called him the saint of the ordinary. And really what San Jose Maria did was he almost prefigured the message of Vatican II. If you really want to boil Vatican II down to one line, it's the universal call to holiness, this idea that we all should become saints. He was preaching this way back in the 1930s, and everyone thought he was a heretic. And now it's the established teaching of the church. It always was, though. It always was. It didn't start with San Jose Maria. It goes back to the gospel. It's nothing more than the original gospel of Jesus Christ. And this is how the early Christians lived their lives. They tried to become saints through ordinary, everyday life. There were no public masses back in the early days of the church. There were no open-air masses at the Colosseum in Rome with the Pope. The Pope was a martyr all the time. Nobody even knew who the Pope was most of the time. There was no television. There was no internet. But the church was growing at an incredible rate of expansion. Every single decade would add hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of converts. How did they do this? Again, it was through the witness of ordinary lives lived for Christ. Most people did not get a chance to meet the Pope and hang out with him and listen to his talks. So this is what it was all about. And so really, God really wanted St. Jose Maria to remind people about this foundational truth of the gospel, that all of us are called to become saints. So this is really the backdrop to this talk by Pope Benedict, who was Cardinal Ratzinger at the time, on this date, October the 6th, 2002, the date of the canonization of St. Jose Maria Escrivá. And you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. So Cardinal Ratzinger said this. What he was thinking about this whole work of God, that St. Jose Maria only thought he was an instrument that God used, like a pencil in his hand, you know, something like Mother Teresa used to say. And he said, while I was pondering this fact, there came to mind the words of the Lord reported in the Gospel of John, in John 5:17, my Father is always working. My Father is always working. These are words spoken by Jesus in the course of a discussion with some religious specialists who did not want to recognize that God could act even on the Sabbath. And the future Pope Benedict said, this is a debate that's still going on in a certain way among people and even among Christians of our own time. Some people think that after creation, God retired and had no longer any interest in our everyday affairs. And that's really what he's talking about there, is this philosophy, this bad theology of deism. I don't know if you've heard about deists, but a lot of the founding fathers of the United States were deists. They basically looked at God as a cosmic watchmaker. He just created everything, created the universe, set it in motion like a watchmaker, you know, makes a watch, sets the gears, winds it up, and from that point on, it's hands off. He just lets it go and lets things kind of develop on their own. I'm not getting involved here. And that's how a lot of people think God is, that he's hands off. He's not involved in the nitty gritty of our day-to-day lives. But this is not the portrait of God that's painted in the Gospels. And so Pope Benedict said, God didn't retire. You know, people think these days that God can no longer enter into the fabric of our daily lives, but the words of Jesus affirm the opposite. Someone who's open to the presence of God discovers that God is always working and still works today. So we should let him enter in and let him do his work. And this is really the point of what St. Jose Maria wanted to say, and this is really the point of what Pope Benedict wanted to say. And we're going to get into in a second how this helps us to overcome fear. And, you know, it's like Batman Begins, the Scarecrow, who's the villain of that movie. He said, I want to just watch the city tear itself apart through fear. And that's, there's so much fear in our culture today. So many events going on in society that make us afraid. And so we got to overcome this. And so the way to overcome this is to understand that God is involved in your life, and he is acting. God's involvement did not stop at the Big Bang, when Pope Benedict talked about that. God's action did not stop at the moment of the Big Bang. It continues on throughout time in the world of nature, in the world of men and women, in our personal lives. And so this is what we have to understand here. And then he talks about how in the book of Exodus, Pope Benedict talked about how in the book of Exodus, in Exodus 33:11, it says about Moses that God would talk to him and speak with him face to face, as a friend speaks with a friend. He said, look, there's a lot we don't understand about that. How exactly did this happen? And he said, look, the veil of discretion hides many details from us. We can apply this kind of thinking to the life of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, this idea of speaking with God as a friend speaks with a friend. And that opens the doors of the world so that God can become present to work and to transform everything. And this is really what holiness means. If the message of the Second Vatican Council is ultimately the universal call to holiness, which we're all called to by our baptism, what is this really all about, this call to holiness? And Pope Benedict, he made this really, really important point, and we all should take this to heart. And again, this is kind of the old way of thinking. He said, when you know a little bit about the history of the saints, and you think about the causes of canonization that are out there, and you read about these people's lives, they always want to find out if someone's sort of up for canonization, did they practice heroic virtue? Heroic virtue. And then we kind of get into this mindset of thinking, man, we have to be superheroes of faith to become saints. We have to be superheroes like the Justice League, you know, in order to be canonized. But that's a mistaken concept of holiness, the Pope said. He said, we kind of think it's not for me because I don't feel capable of being a hero. Not today, at least. No, no way. It's not for me. I can't do it. The goal is too high. So then we start to think that, well, holiness is for other people. Holiness is for the greats. We see their images in stained glass windows. We see them raised to the altars. We think they're so much different from us. We're just ordinary sinners. But that's a mistaken notion of holiness. That's not what holiness is all about. Being a superhero for God and sort of on this level that's completely unattainable. And Pope Benedict said that's exactly what St. Jose Maria was trying to tell people. That's the central point of his message. It doesn't mean, heroic virtue does not mean performing a type of spiritual gymnastics. Okay? We're not, we just got through the Olympics and you've seen incredible feats of athletic prowess. I always think gymnasts are unbelievable, like Simone Biles. I can't believe that they can do what they can do. I dare not try that. I don't want to get up off the couch and try, you know, try a floor routine. I'm going to hurt myself pretty badly. And I can maybe jump about an inch high right now, I'll tell you. But in the same way, we tend to think that with the saints, they were spiritual gymnasts. Like they just did stuff that normal people can't do. But that's not what was really going on. Because heroic virtue means not doing tricks or feats of glory of your own right. It means that you can't do this yourself. So Pope Benedict said, look, when we talk about heroic virtue, we need to redefine this a little bit. It doesn't mean that you've done great things by yourself. It means that in your life, there are things that God does through you, realities that you have not done yourself. Why? Simply because you've opened the door to God in your life. Simply because you've been transparent and you've allowed him to work. In other words, to be a saint, he says, is nothing other than to speak with God as a friend speaks with a friend, just like Moses did. That is holiness. That is holiness. It doesn't mean being superior to others. The saint can actually be really weak with a lot of mistakes in your life, the Pope said. But holiness means that you're in profound contact with God, becoming a friend of God. That's what it's all about, just like Moses spoke with God as a friend. Letting the other, with a capital O, letting God work, because he's the only one who can make you happy. He's the only one who can make you good. As Jesus said to the rich young ruler, right? No one is good but God alone. God is the only one who can do this. So you got to let God work. And so in your weakness, despite all that, despite your sinfulness, God has called you to friendship. And so when we do that, it's all about just putting yourself in God's orbit, putting yourself in a place where God can work on you. Like a potter works with the clay. God talks about this in the book of Jeremiah. He says, you know, I'm the potter, the people are the clay, you're my clay, and I can shape you, I can mold you, but you got to let me... You got to put yourself into my hands so that I can actually do the work. You can't do it by yourself. And so this is really what it's all about. So what did he say in the end? What did Pope Benedict say to the end about how you can overcome fear? This is what it's all about. Because the world has a lot of challenges. There are challenges in the field of work. There are challenges in the economy. There are challenges in society. There's all kinds of challenges in the world. So if you're a person who's opened the door to God, who has this uninterrupted conversation with God as a friend, that's really what prayer is, pray at all times, only then can you respond to these challenges without fear. And here's a great line from Pope Benedict. And I'll quote this directly. For the person who stands in God's hands always falls into God's hands. I love that. The person who stands in God's hands always falls into God's hands. And so fear vanishes. And in its place is born the courage to respond to today's world. So God's got you. God's got you. And this is what gives us the confidence to face the world, to face the challenges of life. And we all have challenges. We all have challenges we're going to face in the future. But we're in God's hands. We can stand in God's hands, and we can also fall into God's hands and let him support us. It's such a great message. And I just thought that was really cool. So that is Pope Benedict's antidote to fear. 1-888-914-9149. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We're going to be right back with a really cool story about faith and umpires of all people. Be right back.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Call 1-888-914-9149. Toll free to talk to me, 888-914-9149. And the person who will answer your phone call is Patrick Alog today. And if he sounds a little bit nervous when he picks up the phone, that's because his LA Dodgers are playing tonight in the wild card game. Yep, the Major League Baseball playoffs have started, and the Dodgers won 106 games, which is phenomenal. And ordinarily, that would get you into the playoffs no problem. But they only squeaked in as a wild card because the San Francisco Giants won 107 games. And, whew, man, that is incredible. The two over 105-win teams got in, and one of them might be going home tonight. For Dodger fans out there, and I know we have a lot of Dodger fans listening on the West Coast, you've got to be biting your nails about this one. Cardinals' hottest team in baseball, St. Louis, playing the Dodgers tonight in the wildcard game. I wanted to talk about this story last night as the playoffs kicked off with the Yankees losing to the Red Sox in the American League wildcard game. And, wow, Cubs fans must have really mixed feelings in the Chicagoland area with Schwarber going deep for the Red Sox and Anthony Rizzo going deep for the Yankees, both former Cubs. Another former Cub, of course, Chris Bryant, another keystone of that 2016 World Series team, is playing for the Giants. So bittersweet for Cubs fans, but lots of exciting baseball ahead of us. And Alan Blinder, writing in the New York Times, he wrote about, we were talking before the break about this idea of finding God in your work. Well, one group of employees in particular has been doing this in a really cool way. Major League umpires finding God together. And he wrote this piece, Alan Blinder, in the New York Times called Before Balls and Strikes, Umpires Make a Call to Pray. And a lot of these guys, I mean, when they usually make a call, it might sound something like this, like Dutch Rennert. Check this out. That was umpire Dutch Rennert ringing up Kevin Mitchell of the San Francisco Giants in the 1989 World Series. Remember that World Series? That was the Earthquake World Series with Oakland. Wow. That was pretty loud, and trust me, the mic was really far away from him when he made that call. A lot of these guys just love to ham it up. And Alan Blinder talks about how these umpires support each other with this weekly prayer group in Major League Baseball. It was kind of cool. And he talked about a time when they did it in Chicago. Everybody calls in at wherever they may be around the country, these guys who are in the group, and they call in at 3 p.m. on a Friday. They might be in St. Louis. They might be in Oakland. This is obviously during the regular season. They might be in Seattle or Cleveland. Doesn't matter. It's time to pray. And I don't know why they pick 3 p.m. on a Friday. Is that because that's the hour when Jesus died? I don't know. The hour of divine mercy. Who knows? But one of the umpires who's kind of the ringleader of this group is Ted Barrett, who's been an ump for over two decades. He's also an ordained Southern Baptist minister. And so on this particular call. And some of the umpires who call in, by the way, they don't identify themselves. They're kind of anonymous. But some people will say, okay, I'm so-and-so and blah, blah, blah. But other guys don't. They just call in. And he was telling them, umpire Ted Barrett was telling the other guys, God is our Father. He loves to hear from us. Don't ever feel like he's too big or too busy to bring your little problem to him. And that's really good advice. That's true. That's true. God does care about the nitty gritty of our lives. He's not, we don't believe in deism. We don't believe he's the cosmic watchmaker who kind of wound it up and let it go. He really does know the number of hairs on our head. He knows what's going on in our lives. He knows, and there's no situation that's too big or too small for him. And a lot of these umpires are going through stuff that people go through in any line of work. Some of them are dealing with family troubles at home. Some of them are processing their anger. Some of them are dealing with addiction. Some of them are in grief. Some of them struggle with the agony of imperfection and loneliness. And those two things in particular are really, really prominent in an umpire's life because they are dealing with imperfection. Sometimes they miss the call. Imagine that. And it's a very, very lonely life. You're kind of out there, and everybody, when the ump gets the call right, everybody loves you. When the ump calls it against your team, you are public enemy number one, especially for the home fans. So they go through a lot of stress. They go through a lot of stress. And so for about a few years now, about 12 of these guys get together, and they call each other every week by phone to pray. And they do this for community because they really can't find this when they're on the road. They're on the road a lot, and it's pretty stressful. Their position, it's on television. Imagine if your job was on TV and everybody was scrutinizing. The way he handed in that report, oh, that was terrible. Terrible. He made a spelling mistake there. Imagine if broadcasters were dicing up your job performance. So one of the other umps who's in this group, David Rackley, who actually was the left field umpire in the All-Star game this year, he said that, quote, knowing that there's a group of guys that get on the call and we're all going through the same journey, we all understand what it's like to be on this journey, just to pray with these guys, it gives us a sense of community, end of quote. And by the way, baseball is actually, statistically speaking, maybe the most Christian sport, maybe. You guys might remember, especially Dodger fans out in the LA area or all over the country. Remember Oral Hershiser, that incredible pitcher for the Dodgers when they upset the Oakland A's in the 1988 World Series? Everybody remembers the Kirk Gibson home run in game one. That was just incredible. But don't forget, Oral Hershiser was really famous for praying on the mound while he was pitching. And during the World Series, he was often seen, people could like kind of read his lips, and he was singing hymns on the mound. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, all you creatures here below. And he even went on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and sung that hymn for Johnny Carson. And I was trying to find some audio of that, but unfortunately it's not on YouTube. But I did find the final out of the 1988 World Series, and Oral Hershiser was on the mound for the Dodgers. Check this out.
3-2 to Tony Phillips. Lansford down the line from third with two out. Steinbach on deck. 5-2 Dodgers in the ninth. Got him. They've done it. Like the 1969 Mets, it's the impossible dream revisited. A fastball, nine strikeouts for Hershiser. He gives up a total of four hits.
Yeah, Oral Hershiser was dominant that year. Had the consecutive, I forget how many innings, 56 consecutive scoreless innings, I don't know if my memory's fuzzy on that. You can correct me on that, Patrick. But won the World Series. They beat the mighty Oakland A's with the Bash Brothers, McGuire and Canseco, who obviously got embroiled later on in a steroid scandal. But anyway, so he was well known for his faith. And even the modern-day Dodgers, Clayton Kershaw, who's great pitcher, centerpiece of the World Series championship team last year. He wrote a book with his wife, Ellen, about their faith. And they've actually done studies on this. In 2018, there was a prof at Eastern Illinois University who found that 8% of Major League Baseball players have at least one Bible verse in their Twitter biographies, and a little bio at the top of their Twitter page. And that is a higher share than any other major sport. It's higher than the NBA. It's higher than the NFL or the NHL. And so there's always been this element of faith in baseball. We talked a couple months ago about Jackie Robinson. There's a book that came out about his faith called 42 Faith. He had to have a lot of faith to endure what he did. And there's always been a tradition of pregame chapels in baseball, as there are in some other sports too. But a lot of people don't like this tradition. It's been criticized a lot. But I even have a priest friend who will do pregame masses for the Toronto Blue Jays, you know, when they're home at the Sky Dome. I refuse to call it the Rogers Center. I just won't do that. It's the Sky Dome. And you know, anybody who's Catholic or anybody else who wants to come can go to this pregame mass. So that's kind of cool. And but really, it's something that umpires, they kind of have to live this in a different way, because they're not allowed really. I mean, they just don't interact with the players. They don't interact with the managers of the other teams, because they might have to make a call against them. They don't want to be accused of favoritism or anything like that. So they're kind of set apart. And one of the things that the article said by Alan Blinder, running for the New York Times, was that I had the blinders on there and the blinkers on. Anyways, but Alan Blinder, writing for the New York Times about the umpires, he said that, you know, in decades past, especially in the decades after World War II, a lot of these umps were in the war. A lot of them had really hard driving lives. A lot of them were haunted by the war. They would drink a lot. They would party a lot. And things are a little bit different today. But it's tough. Anybody who travels a lot for their work, they know how tough it is. And these guys are, there's only 76 umpires in the major leagues. They travel in crews of four. They can't really hang out with the players, as I talked about. And so it just seems like their life is a blur. Airports and then fastballs and hotels and brightly lit ballparks, television, people yelling at them. And so it can be a tough place. And so they find an anchor in prayer. So one of the things that umpire Ted Barrett said, that he said that Jesus would have been a great umpire, because he wasn't a milquetoast. He wouldn't have allowed himself to get run over. And he said, you see him standing up to the Pharisees. He would have been able to give it right back to people on the field. But of course, every call he made would have been perfect. But of course. And so their faith really does help them. Maybe when an umpire, or when a manager rather, is yelling at them, and we all know famous baseball arguments, well, they'll just turn their caps backwards and just yell at each other's face, yelling at the umps. It helps these guys to maybe not fire back and maybe not use coarse language, and to really have a more spiritual outlook on their work, which we all kind of need to do. And so one example of something that happened in one of the Friday prayer calls that the umpires take part in was that one of the guys said, you know what, make sure tonight when you're umping the game, make sure you take a moment to just look up at the stars and just thank God for his creation. Just bring the presence of God into your work. And your work happens to be being a major league umpire. So that's really cool. And one of the other guys, David Rackley, said that, you know, very often we hide in our cave like David did. Remember in King David, he was being hunted by King Saul and he was hiding in a cave. We hide in our cave like David did when we're being attacked. And that can be attacks from the world. It can be spiritual attacks. It can be the profession. We have a high-profile game. We miss a call. We make a mistake. Everybody knows it. We tend to hide in our caves. And being alone is not a good thing in this world. End of quote. And that's very true, that the enemy wants to isolate us. He wants to get us, he likes to play one-on-one. And we can't do that. As Catholics, we need each other. We've got to get support from each other. And so these weekly prayer calls that the umpires have on Friday afternoons at 3 o'clock really helps them to be accountable to one another and to really pray for one another. So it only takes about 30 minutes for these guys. But for a lot of these guys, it continues on. A lot of them have decided to continue on their faith formation by having Bible studies together. They'll meet in restaurants, spring training, and meet at a Cracker Barrel or something and crack open the Bible, start talking about it. A lot of them read spiritual books together and talk to each other about the book. Or they'll go on a 3-day retreat, make that an annual thing. So really how deep they want to take it, they kind of leave it up to each guy. But it's really cool that they're helping each other and they're encouraging one another. And just with the baseball playoffs starting up, I just thought there was a really cool story by Alan Blinder in the New York Times. And so that's what we need too. We really do need We need friends. We need people who we can be accountable to. I think that's why spiritual direction is a great thing, because we can't do this alone. God doesn't want us to be lone rangers, and we need to do it. That's what these guys are doing. And just one last quote from the article by umpire Ted Barrett. He told the umpires during one of the calls, as you walk on the field tonight, know that the Holy Spirit gives you power. I love you guys. Jesus loves you guys. Jesus loves umpires. Jesus loves umpires. Yes, he does. So remember that when you're thinking about screaming at the TV tonight. Anyways, we'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Well, I was telling you a couple days ago, I was working on this story. There's a really bizarre article that came out in the Jerusalem Post saying, really asking this question, are the Taliban descendants of Israel? A lot of people are saying that some people in the Taliban are actually members of the lost tribes of Israel. This is quite bizarre. This article by Michael Freund in the Jerusalem Post. And this is not a new idea, by the way. This has really been something that people have been talking about in recent days, obviously with Afghanistan falling back into the hands of the Taliban, and with the anniversary of September 11th still fresh in our mind, people are talking about this. But there was a documentary that came out in 2010, I remember, about this concept that the Taliban might be descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. And I remember even back in 2001, around the time of September the 11th, there was a YouTube video about this concept. And really the question is about the Pashtun tribes who make up most of the Taliban. And it's the Pashtuns that people are saying are descendants of the lost tribes. And so this has always been a subject of fascination, the lost tribes of Israel. And I'm going to tell you about where they came from, how this all happened in just a moment. And by the way, there is a Catholic perspective on who the lost tribes of Israel are. And recently on the Faith Explained show, we did this series on Mormonism. Mormons think that the lost tribes of Israel actually migrated on Kontiki rafts across the oceans and landed in North and South America and created these incredible civilizations. And then Jesus visited them afterwards. Well, there's zero evidence for this, by the way, archaeologically. DNA studies, anything like that. So that's kind of embarrassing, but we did deal with all of that on the Faith Explained program. You can look up the podcasts on those at relevantradio.com. But many of the Taliban are part of the, or members of the Pashtun tribes. And there are apparently tens of millions of Pashtuns living all over the world, but most of them live in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India. Lots of clans, several hundred of them, lots of tribes that have tried to preserve their heritage. So at any rate, a lot of the Pashtuns had declared themselves to be the sons of Israel, or Bani Israel, which means sons of Israel. And that's a tradition that their ancestors passed down through the generations. And even as far back as the 13th century, many Islamic travelers and historians noted this. And they said, you know, really, it doesn't make any sense that they should say that they're related to the Israelites, especially during the times of Islamic conquest. But this tradition kind of just keeps hanging on. In his 1858 book called The History of the Afghans, Joseph Pierre Ferrier wrote that the chief of one of the main Pashtun tribes, which are called the Yusufzai, which means the sons of Joseph, presented the Persian Shah with a Bible written in Hebrew and a lot of other articles that were used in ancient worship that they had preserved. In 1861, there was a major named Major Henry Bellew who served in the British colonial Indian Army, and he wrote a book called The Lost Tribes, and he asserts that, hey, the Pashtuns might be descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. The nomenclature that they use. There's lots of different theories about this. But anyways, even actually a recent president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, in 1957, he wrote a book called The Exiled and the Redeemed, and he devoted an entire chapter to Afghan tribes and the traditions of their origins. At any rate, he wrote this. He said, quote, "The Afghan tribes among whom the Jews have lived for generations are Muslims who retain to this day their amazing tradition that they are descended from the 10 tribes." He notes that the evidence in our possession is insufficient for practical conclusions to be drawn from, but he says the fact that this tradition has persisted among these tribes is a weighty consideration. They have been saying this for centuries, and they actually even continue practices like circumcision on the eighth day after birth. They don't mix meat and milk, which modern day Jews still don't do, Orthodox Jews, lighting candles on the eve of the Sabbath, the practice of Levirate marriage, which was done in the Old Testament time. So people think, oh, maybe there is something to this. I'm personally a little skeptical about this. I'm pretty skeptical about this. There's actually lots of groups that say that they're descended from the lost tribes of Israel. I was reading in the New York Times about some groups in Myanmar and parts of India that say, oh yeah, we're part of the lost tribes too. And they're actually, some of them will try to emigrate to Israel saying, hey, we're descendants of the lost tribes. We're coming back. There's actually been some DNA studies that have even tried to prove this. And in the comments to this article in the Jerusalem Post, there was one guy who mentioned this. And in actuality, there was a DNA study that was done that seemed to link the Pashtuns to perhaps the lost tribes of Israel. But in fact, it turned out to be from a genetic influx, what they found, that was from the early Neolithic period. And by the way, that was about 12,000 years ago, about 8,000 years before Abraham. So it was actually before the beginnings of the Jewish people. So this tribe that they found this DNA in, they actually couldn't be descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. Anyway, so there's lots of debate about this. What does this mean? But there is a Catholic angle. I don't buy into this, by the way. I don't know. We'll have to look. But is there a Catholic angle on the lost tribes of Israel? There actually is. There actually is. And Michael Barber mentions this. He wrote an excellent book about the book of Revelations called Coming Soon. And, you know, when you sing that Christmas song, and yeah, Christmas is coming really soon, sooner than we might realize, O come, Emmanuel. You know that song. There's that line, ransom captive Israel. What is that talking about? Well, yeah, it talks about being a slave to sin. We've got to be redeemed. But it's also referring to the deliverance of the captives, the lost tribes that were taken into captivity. So when Israelite tribes, these lost 10 tribes, went into captivity, it's because they rejected God's ways. They rejected his covenant. In other words, they fell into sin. So they need to be set free from sin as well. And Deuteronomy, in the book of Deuteronomy, it says the exile will end when Israel returns to the Lord. Forgiveness of sins is another way of saying come back, return from exile. Well, in the book of Revelation, we have this. We have this 144,000. And in our series on the Faith Explained, we looked at the Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witnesses think this means that there's only 144,000 people in heaven. That's not what it means. So this is in Revelation chapter 7. And what does it say? These 144,000, it's a symbolic number, by the way. It means 12 times 12 times 1,000. The 12 tribes of Israel times the 12 apostles of the new Israel, the church, times 1,000. That's a number of perfection. It's the fullness of people in heaven. So who's this 144,000? Out of every tribe, it says, of the sons of Israel, the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Reuben. They came up with the Reuben sandwich, just kidding. The tribe of Gad, the tribe of Asher, the tribe of Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, 12,000 from each tribe. 12,000 out of the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 out of Benjamin. So that's where the 144,000 come from. And that's what it really means. So here's just a little quick breakdown of the timeline. So in 1000 BC, King David reigned over all the tribes. And then in 930 BC, remember counting down to year zero, you know, in the BC period, in 930 BC, the northern tribes broke away and formed their own kingdom that was called the House of Israel or the House of Ephraim. So the southern kingdom, which contained Jerusalem, that became known as the House of Judah. And that's where the name the Jews comes from. It comes from the Judahites. So the southern kingdom becomes the House of Judah. The northern kingdom is the House of Israel. So it's a divided kingdom. In 722 BC, the Assyrians, we're talking about the Assyrians on the Faith Explained right now because we're talking about the book of Jonah. Jonah goes to Nineveh, the great capital city of the Assyrians, and these guys are brutal. These guys are absolutely monsters. The Assyrians carry the northern tribes off into exile and scatter them to the nations. They're never heard from again. These are the 10 lost tribes of Israel. So basically what happened was they started intermarrying with the peoples, and nobody could figure out whether, I mean, they just kind of assimilated, and that's what happened to them. Then in 586 BC, the southern tribes got carried off into exile too by the Babylonians, but they come back. They come back in 538. The northern tribes, the lost 10 tribes, never come back. Nobody knows what's happened to them. So that's kind of always been a subject of a lot of fascination. So where are they? We don't know. They basically got assimilated into the nations, into all the people groups of the world. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. God says he's going to bring all the tribes back together in a new exodus. And this is where the church comes in. Why did St. Paul, why was he the apostle to the Gentiles? Why, he went to Jews as well. But here's what he said in the Acts of the Apostles, Acts 26, verse 7. Paul says, I'm holding to the promises to which our 12 tribes hope to attain. Well, hang on here. 10 of the tribes are missing. How are you going to find them? Well, that's why Paul went to the Gentiles, because that's where the other 10 tribes were. They're all amongst the Gentiles. Nobody knows who they are anymore. But here's the thing. If I can convert the Gentiles and bring them into the church, then I'm automatically bringing the lost tribes into the church. And this is really what it's all about. So God's basically saying, you may not know exactly where the lost tribes are, but I do. I know who are the real descendants of the lost tribes. And if you just bring in all the nations, guess what? You're going to bring these guys in as a bonus. So this is what it's all about. And that's why St. Paul says in Romans 11, all Israel will be saved. And this is how it's going to happen. It's through the church. It's through the 144,000. Again, it's not literal number of people. It's the 12 tribes times the 12 apostles times 1,000, the number of perfection. And so the full number of Gentiles is going to come in. And guess what? That's how the 10 tribes are going to get back in too. And that's why in Revelation, in chapter 7, there's this great vision in heaven. There's more than 144,000 people here because it says there's a great multitude that nobody can number. So forget your 144,000 being a literal number. In Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, a great multitude which no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and all peoples and all tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And the Lamb, of course, is Jesus. So that's incredible. That's really amazing. And that's one of the key messages of the book of Revelation. There's going to be a new exodus. When Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration, he's chatting with Moses. What are they talking about? And Elijah, they're talking about the exodus, Luke says, that he's going to accomplish at Jerusalem, the new exodus. So as Michael Barber says, hey, in the first exodus, God saved Israel by delivering them from the Egyptians. But in the new exodus, Israel is going to come back to God. But this time, the nations are coming with them, everybody else. And so that's how God is going to make a Catholic scene here. And that's why the Catholic Church is for all peoples. It's for everybody. How cool is that? So that's a Catholic take on the lost tribes. Wow, what a show today. Had a lot of fun. We'll be back again tomorrow. Of course, Tim Reese coming up next, followed by the Family Rosary Across America. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog, chewing his nails, worrying about those Dodgers, took your calls. Take it away, Michaela. See you tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.